Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Rule the Roost podcast. I'm your host, Tatrunk, and here's the other host, Raj Baines. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. You, son?
Very good, very good. Book coming along well?
Yeah, it's coming along.
Yeah? Good man, good man.
Coming along.
We've done lots of big introductions, so I'll plug it towards the end again for you, mate. Right, yeah,
whatever.
We'll crack on with Sunday straight up. It's still fresh in the memory. How are you feeling overall, mate? What's your sort of vibe on the way the game went?
It was a good 1-0 win at home. I mean, Rafa Benitez, his tactics are really sort of... do you like what I did there?
I like that. No, I like that.
No, it was, it was a bit shit, to be honest. They didn't get out of first gear, never mind third. And they didn't really, apart from hitting the bar and stuff, they didn't look to trouble the goal apart from when that wonderful own goal flew in, which is still funny regardless of the result. But it was just, it was weirdly flat, and you don't know if it's Wembley or it's just a slow start to the season or something. It's just, it was quite painful to watch.
I can't really argue any of that, mate. I think the important thing that I will caveat my upcoming thoughts with is I think bigger picture wise, we're going to be all right. I think, you know, a lot of what we've said previously doesn't disappear. We've got a very good squad. We have some very, very good players. We need some more backup. We knew that was evident from the semi-final against Chelsea last year. And I think that was evident from this match as well. That even though Chelsea were kind of light, as it were, they still could bring players like Pedro off the bench.
But it's not as if they outplayed us in they took their game to us. It was more they did a job on us in a manner that a smaller club would. I mean, I joked about Benitez before, but it's the sort of performance that Rafa Benitez tried to have Newcastle do against Huddersfield. Just his team isn't as good as Chelsea's is. So... They did that whole sucking us in and hitting us on the break and all that sort of shite. And it's one of those things where we should have known better.
This is exactly it. This is why I don't really buy into I don't buy into the fact we were unlucky. I don't particularly believe in luck and that kind of thing. We didn't create that many meaningful chances. If we're going to say it's unlucky that Harry Kane hit the post, then Chelsea are unlucky that Willian hit the post in the second half. If we're going to say that they're lucky that Marcus Alonso scored a great free kick, then I think you're kind of straw clutching. And also, more to the fact, I think we've given away a number of free kicks against Chelsea in similar positions in these games at Wembley. They obviously play for it. You could see David Luiz, who I think had a great game, so I'm not taking anything away from him. I actually think he was particularly brilliant for them, annoyingly, even though I really dislike the man. But he was playing for fouls constantly, and we just kept giving them to them. And there's little things like that where we don't seem to wise up, which irritates me a bit, because Chelsea will do that. They will shithouse you, you know, as we kind of joke about, and they did that again. But in terms of us outplaying them, I know this isn't what you're saying, this is just kind of a lot of the discussion around the match is that, well, you know, we dominated them, we outplayed them, but to me it doesn't really count so much in the respect that, as you've said, they set up for that eventuality. They invited us on, and we were just so lacking in ideas. Like they had those two solid banks. They had that solid sort of defensive midfield bank, and then their actual defence itself. That lad they had, the stand-in, a centre back, not Rudiger. Yeah, I thought he was absolutely brilliant. Like a really, really decent player. But we just seemed to keep trying the same thing. We kept trying to attack him through the middle. Maybe we're a victim of the fact that Kieran Trippier didn't have the best game, that, you know, Ben Davies isn't the most athletic, as we've kind of said, going down the left. But we seemed to play with no width at all. And I just felt that nothing that we really did was that meaningful. And that's what bothered me about it. It's all well and good to have a lot of possession. But I didn't really see us carve out that many sort of gilt-edged chances.
I think where Chelsea won the game was that Conte went in and prepared for that match, having already conceded that Tottenham were the better side. And Chelsea never played as if they thought they were better, and their tactics matched that. So it was a far cannier, far more pragmatic approach to the match than what Tottenham had. Because we've talked about sort of how we try and impose ourselves on teams and the way we try to approach them. And if that overload doesn't work, then there has to be a way of working around that again. And there has been in the past, as change of formations and, you know, people coming off the bench and things, introducing the likes of, you know, Son and what have you. But there was no real reaction to the way that Chelsea played. It was sort of trying the same thing over and over again. Which was disappointing. It's not as if that didn't work at times, because, you know, on another day, Harry Kane doesn't hit the post, and in another month, Harry Kane doesn't miss the post, I should probably say.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, there were moments of class. Eriksen put in a couple of really good crosses where they just needed a touch and they didn't come. So I don't think that's a lack of luck. It was just Tottenham not being at their best on a day where they needed to be. And perhaps there's been one too many of those when the big teams come. Perhaps there is still a bit of a mental block when it comes to playing against and beating other top four sides. It used to be away. And again, I think maybe subconsciously rather than, you know, something that's on the surface of it, not being at White Hart Lane may affect them, because it's not the same atmosphere, it's not the same surroundings, it's not that same comfort and feeling of home that your actual home stadium gives you. It's not the same as playing away, obviously, because of the difference in numbers and everything, but it's still adjustment for our players in a way it hadn't been previously. So I think it's a very easy line and perhaps a lazy one to immediately point to Wembley, but I think there is mentally probably something there. And the reason you point to mental things with not just the top four sides, but with playing in a different stadium, is that quality-wise, you can't really question that side, the one that was put out. There's enough quality there to beat the Chelsea side that was put in front of them. And it was the intangible things that what went wrong, and they're the things to be looked at rather than personnel specifically. In my opinion, at least.
I mean, because Victor Wanyama, people sort of criticise him for a bad game, and he didn't have the best of games, but to me, he looked about 40, 50% fit, really.
Yeah, he was weirdly slow, and he wasn't putting himself about as he normally would. I don't know what was wrong with him. Maybe he's not well or something, I'm not sure. People do have bad games. That's probably one of his worst ever in his
career. Yeah, definitely.
Because he's never played that poorly in my mind for a long time. And, you know, there was one or two mistakes. A lot's been made about Hugo Lloris, which is, you know, a really interesting point, and one that I sort of, having tweeted about him and whatnot and had the response I had, was quite eye-opening for me, because I didn't realise there was as many people who doubted him and essentially think he chucks one in against every big team we've ever played.
I'll tell you what, because we had a question from Aaron at Juice Yoda, who says, Hugo Lloris, hero or villain? And I saw your exchange, so I'm assuming you fall on the hero side of the spectrum with this one.
The way I think of it is that Hugo Lloris does far more right than he ever does wrong for Tottenham, and he is in so much credit given what he does over the course of a season that you can't really crucify him when one odd mistake comes along. And I think there's an element of confirmation bias where mistakes are, because they'll stick in the memory far more than, you know, good saves or good catches or alleviating pressure or anything like that will in sort of a routine win, because they're more memorable and they hurt more, because that's what defeat is. So if he has a bad game against Man City and he has a bad game or lets in an easy goal here or there in you know, another match, they will be more memorable than, you know, what he does well is. But people often talk about goalkeepers in terms of how many points they win or lose you a season. And if you're looking at Hugo Lloris through that paradigm, I think I'm right in saying he's the goalkeeper who's probably conceded the least goals over the past two seasons and been part of the best defence over the past two seasons. And if he was the sort of keeper who crumbled under pressure and let goals in for no good reason, they wouldn't be those statistics. He wouldn't be part of a good defence, because a poor goalkeeper weakens a defence, and I don't think he does.
I think it's what we've always nodded to as well. I don't think either of us have ever said that Hugo Lloris is perfect, and we've often alluded to
very obvious
that.
Flaws.
Well, exactly, and we've often alluded to the fact that this is why he's still at Spurs, really. But who do you bring in that's better than him?
I think he's one of the best five goalkeepers in the world. I think you can count on one hand the goalkeepers that are fundamentally better at their jobs than he is in every other department. And, you know, Tottenham won't be able to get anyone better than him, and that's not as if we should be looking for anyone better than him, because it's ridiculous. Well, it's almost as if, you know, saying that Harry Kane doesn't score in August would lead somebody to go, oh, Tottenham might need to look at a different striker. It's that sort of a thing. It's really, it's something I can't quite get my head around, because he's so good at what he does, and it's, you know, has done so much right for Spurs in his time here, and clearly been the outstanding player for a while, that on the odd occasion that he does make a mistake and there's such a huge overreaction to what he does, I'm never quite sure as to why that is or where that comes from. Because what's the alternative? Where's this perfect goalkeeper that people think there is that's suddenly going to come from?
Someone like Jack Butland that people seem to keep mentioning, which I don't really get what he's done other than be a promising acquisition in Football Manager, that he's done in real terms to suggest that he's a tangibly better goalkeeper than Hugo Lloris.
Grass is always greener, isn't it? You know, it's the same reason why people constantly go on about new signings, and people seem to think the league is won and lost over that sidebar on Sky Sports, who's got the most people coming in on the in column rather than what's actually being done on the field. It's such a weird way to think about the sport. It's almost as if we often talk about how football is a business, and you know, we concede that, and you know, we use the words and we talk about it in marketing context, and we do that because you have to, really, to sort of understand what the sport is this day in sort of 360 manner. But it's almost as if people have taken that too far to heart, and they'll think that that actually has more of an impact than it does. I've seen writers, I mean, Rory Smith especially, has been really vocal on the fact that he would like to see Tottenham do really well this season, almost to dispel this myth that the more signings you make, the better your team is. Because if we look at the one season where Tottenham did make a shit ton of signings, it was the worst season in living memory, not living memory, but the worst season in recent memory, at least, that we've had. And it's just that it's one of the most maddening things I can think of. It's this weird false equivalency that spunking a shitload of money and bringing in loads of players is going to make it better. If that was the case, Everton would be a better side than Tottenham are right now, but they're not, because they're buying average players for too much money and they've bought a shitload of them. And it's just a weird thing that I don't understand. And it's sort of losses at Spurs always bring you know, the stupidest people out of the woodwork. And these are the people who are often the quietest when it's good. You know, when we went on those that 10-match winning streak and whatnot, you hardly got an idiot coming out. It was, the mood was better. People sort of, their understanding seemed to be better. But as soon as there's a loss, they're looking for problems that aren't there, and they're trying to overcorrect things that don't need overcorrecting. It's a really strange.
As much as I don't disagree with anything that you're saying, particularly, just in terms of exploring the topic of Lloris and his ability in big games, because that seems to be the thing that's been mentioned a bit. Do you know if the actual goal, the size of the goals at Wembley is bigger? Because apparently, in all of our games at Wembley, of the 12. Basically, Hugo Lloris has conceded 12 goals from 15 shots on target at Wembley, which seems like a pretty high ratio for him. That's six games at Wembley, 12 goals from 15 shots on target. And I wonder if that's something to do with maybe his height. I mean, when we
the size of the goals are the same in every single stadium. I don't think.
Really, I
think that's a fundamental part of football, is that the size of the goal is the same in every stadium. I think the depth of the nets might be bigger than they are elsewhere. They're sort of that weird cuboid. But as far as the posts are concerned, I'm fairly sure that to the millimeter they're probably identical. Otherwise, that's a fairly big, differential to have in the sport where that's the thing everyone's kicking the fucking ball at. I'm not sure goals are different. Maybe the stadium just does something to him as well that is different. One thing that this may be a false equivalency of my own, but one thing that has brought to mind is I can't remember who said it, but I was listening to something once when somebody was on about being able to shoot around in an NBA arena, and they're like, you know, when you have a normal basketball hoop and it's just a brick wall behind, or just, you know, a plain wall behind in a normal gym, your spatial awareness allows you to shoot a lot better. But because they're sort of, when you're shooting in an NBA arena, there's 20,000 seats behind you, and sort of it's a glass back, and you can't really judge it as well. It's harder to get used to that because you're looking at something different and the surroundings are different and stuff like that. And Wembley seems to have that same sort of cavernous effect as that maybe something that sort of he feels different about his surroundings. I'm not sure. It's just it's a pure guess, but he's one of the last people I would ever go to crucify. If I was to start victim blaming anyone, his throw out to Wanyama wasn't the best, but Wanyama had more than enough time to take a touch and, you know, if he needed to just hoof it out of play, he didn't need to try and turn or take an extra touch or do whatever he did. It's, you know, they're both as to blame as one another where that is concerned. The shot entirely, you know, he should have done better. I'm not sure why he's not just put side of his foot on it. He doesn't often make many saves with his feet. Thinking back, he does tend to be able to get down to the ground fairly quickly, but it's just one of those where he's made a mistake, and you know you can't really change it. And if that was something, a flaw in his game that happened often, then you could point to it and you could point a correlation out. But I'm not sure that's there. And even in big games when things have happened, I don't think it's purely because he's been the cause of that. I think the defence as a whole has been unsure in bigger matches because they're asked different questions. About 10 minutes into the game, Alvaro Morata had that free header.
Yeah.
Nobody was in 10 yards of him, and we had three centre-backs on the field. So that's not Hugo Lloris's fault. I saw somebody questioned his positioning for the free kick as well. It's one of those where I didn't watch Match of the Day yesterday, but if I had, I imagine somebody said if you had two goalkeepers in the goal, neither of them would have saved it.
It was an exceptional free kick. I think that's
ridiculous.
Absolute bollocks. Like the fact that people saying he should have done better for the free kick. He definitely should have done better for the second goal. But like you say, it's Hugo Lloris, you know.
It was a silly free kick as well for Dele Alli to give away, especially in that position. He didn't need to stick his heel out or whatever he did in that position. especially at the timing of it as well. But there's nothing the goalkeeper can do from there. There's nothing the wall can do from there because it was put... he could take that free kick 100 more times and he wouldn't hit it better. So it's one of, that's another one you have to write off. I mean, if people think that's unlucky, maybe it is, but these things happen in sport. It's just one of those where it's disappointing because it's happened so early on in the season. Spurs were favourites. There's this whole Wembley narrative surrounding it. We went through the whole of last season unbeaten at home, and it's taken us one game at Wembley to be beaten already. There's already a growing unrest because the season started and people haven't got the 50 signings they want through the door. And it always seems that Spurs have a standing start to the season. It always seems as if there's something that people have to complain about around this time of the year. And it's almost as if the reason why, you know, when it comes into the running and stuff like that, Spurs are playing catch-up is because we've gone through this August and September where everyone's decided to have mild civil war and then settle down before we actually start, you know, having a united front of a October through to the end of the season. It's a strange pattern that seems to repeat itself. I'm not a huge fan of it.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. It is... I see what's frustrating. I think it's a kick in the bollocks to lose to Chelsea, right? That's the annoying thing. It's that, again, it's kind of like you say, it's almost along that confirmation bias line of things whereby we're being told... all summer long, Spurs have this hoodoo at Wembley, and you know, there is that going to carry on into the new year? And then we kind of almost saw this cut and paste of the semi-final against Chelsea play out again in this match, in so much as we dominate possession, probably should have gotten a draw, but still Chelsea managed to overcome us. So I think that's largely a part of the frustration. I think it's also perhaps maybe it's people just waking up to the fact really that, you know, White Hart Lane is gone, that Wembley is our home for now. Because I mean, that match day experience is not great. It's really not great. I mean, the kudos to the trust. I don't you know, take a shot at them for anything. I know they've worked very hard to make sure that it feels like home, but it just isn't, you know. It's walking up to this ground that's in the middle of like an industrial park when you've got outlet stores and shopping centres and stuff all around it. It's just all so artificial. It's just pretty vapid, you know. And going there this early in the season to play in a game like Chelsea, I didn't even feel that much of a buzz about it. It didn't really feel like we were playing Chelsea at home. It just felt like a game against Chelsea, like some sort of exhibition match or something. I don't know. It will take some getting used to. And if there's a bedding in period for fans, then it stands to reason that there would be a bedding in period for the players as well. We just got to hope that doesn't span on for too long. I guess one final thing I wanted to mention from the game, was that, at least for me, Kieran Trippier stood out. He was almost alarmingly a non-entity for me, I felt. In so much as I don't think he really did anything particularly that bad, but there was no thrust there from him. And I think he got into the position where he's supposed to be showing off the fact he can deliver, yeah, a decent ball, but he didn't even really manage that throughout the game.
Well, it looked like a player who'd been injured and hadn't had a run-up as he needed to.
Yeah, fair.
You know, he's been pushed in the deep end. I mean, I don't know why, after having seen how Trippier played and clearly wasn't fit, clearly wasn't match sharp. He may have been match fit. He got through what he needed to get through in terms of, you know, running up and down. But there was no real spark to his game, as you say. If Kyle Walker-Peters is putting a man in the match shift at Newcastle, I know there's... want to protect him, but you know, there's no harm in giving him a crack against Chelsea, because
no. I felt a little
he couldn't have played any worse than Trippier did. And no. Now the opposite is, if you try to protect Walker-Peters, you've put Trippier into no man's land, unfit and, you know, not ready to play that level of football, and you've got everybody who wants to stick a boot into him because Kyle Walker got sold doing so now. So you almost cut off your nose to spite your face where that's concerned. And it was almost as if the lesser of two evils would have been to give Kyle Walker-Peters that experience of playing at home, playing in front of the home fans, and seeing how he did. Because you can write that off as a test. You can go, you know what, he played really well against Newcastle. He's earned his chance here in this bigger game. Kieran Trippier is not fully fit yet. We had no other opportunity. And you can almost protect him that way and say that, you know, he was played because he'd earned the right to play and we had no other opportunity. And that's your safety net. He does really well. And you get to say, look at how good this player is we've produced. He plays badly and you go, you know what, he's not ready for this level. We didn't think he was, but we had no alternative. So, that's hindsight's 20/20, but perhaps that's an avenue we should have explored more than we had, because it's not as if he's been shy about chucking in players in big games before. I think Ryan Mason made his debut in a Arsenal game away. Harry Kane played over players like Soldado and Adebayor, who are more senior than he is. He's done it all the way through his time at Tottenham. So there's no reason as to why he should suddenly be tentative about these players, you know, having a crack in the first team. That's sort of one of the things we're most happy with Pochettino, with his, you know, the size of his bollocks when it comes to putting youth team players and getting the best out of them.
Would you like to see us still sign a right back before the window closes, if the correct one comes along, perhaps someone a bit more in the Kyle Walker mould?
Doesn't even have to be in the Kyle Walker mould, I don't think, as long as it's a player that Pochettino thinks he can get to a level that is either significantly better than Kieran Trippier or can challenge him for his position, then yeah, there's obviously a gap that needs to be filled there. I don't want somebody signing just for the sake of signing, but you know, if there's a right signing to be made, then make it by all means. But we're obviously not shy of signing anyone or shy of signing people for the right money if we think they're the right fit, because Davinson Sanchez hasn't come cheap. So it's one of those where I imagine the club are happy to wait themselves.
I will be interested to see in with regard to Davinson Sanchez, because Flav did a little podcast with Priya Ramesh this week, who talks about the Eredivisie quite a lot. She's a journalist. And he did just a little pod on Davinson Sanchez. And one of the things she really sort of focused on was the fact that he's very quick. He's very athletic. He's got a decent tackle on him, so to speak. But he's very raw.
Child.
Yeah, he's young enough and he's very raw. And I do wonder if in any way we are looking at potentially moulding him into some sort of fullback, wingback, whichever way you want to call it, to fill in one of those positions. Because it does seem strange, unless we really are preparing for Alderweireld to go next season.
I don't think it's that. I think Wimmer's going, isn't he? So it's just improving what we already have. I don't think we have to be so fatalistic about these things. It's just one of those where there's a great player available at the right age that Tottenham look for. The price has obviously gone up because the price goes up because of what the market is. And we're signing him because we're going to lose another one of the players that the manager doesn't think is right. And he's found somebody that is. So there's no need to suddenly go, oh my God. It's not as if, you know, when we signed Pau Lopez, everyone's going, oh no, this means Hugo Lloris is going. There's obviously five dickheads that thought Hugo Lloris isn't a good keeper and they want him to go. But I think that's a stretch personally. It may end up being the truth, but I don't think that's the thinking behind it.
I do wonder though if it means we're going to be sticking with the back three a lot more. Only so much as because apparently he did turn down a few other moves because he wasn't so keen on taking a development role. So, it stands to reason that he's coming to Spurs to actually play.
We're not going to sign anyone for 40 million and sit him on the bench. He's going to be playing and he's going to be playing regularly. I don't know. The one concern I would have is what that means for Eric Dier, because it's his position that'll be going. If that means Dier's going back to right back, where he obviously hated it, I'm not sure whether or not
maybe
he's
to midfield.
Fighting. well, he's got to take Victor Wanyama's jumper off him on the weekend's display, then it might be an easier task than it was last season. But Wanyama's been a fantastic player more often than he hasn't for Spurs.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the main thing that I'm sort of annoyed about, not just in the performance, but the reaction to it, is that there's such a quickness to forget what has come before, and this real ability to suddenly just go, oh, he's clearly not good enough because he's had one bad game and something like that, where if you look at the wider picture and you look at the sort of what they've done in a Spurs shirt for longer than that, it's not as if we're going, oh, Victor Wanyama was really good for as Spurs player 10 years ago. We're in about, what, 3 months ago or whatever it was. It's not as if he's suddenly gone shit over the summer. He's just had one bad game. So it's a really strange way. I know people take losses in derby games a lot harder than they do other ones. And, you know, I was watching it in a bar with my mates and, you know, they took piss out of me because I went quiet for half an hour. After the game finishes, you know, if I'd at home and I was with my dad, we'd have ranted and raved for 10 minutes and got it out of my system. But because I'm with Huddersfield and Leeds fans, they don't really want to hear me do that. So I just sort of sat there for half an hour quiet on my own. And, you know, they noticed after a while and went, what are you so quiet for? And it's just one of those things where we have to process it and move on. Because you do. I mean, all the things you think of after a win, you're sort of like, oh, this has got to happen, that's got to happen. But you suddenly realise you're overcorrecting. I think that's something that perhaps this fan base is not uniquely a thing that we do, but it's something we do quite often as well. And to credit where it's due, and that same sort of thinking, Antonio Conte has not suddenly become a shit manager over the summer either. You know, Chelsea didn't do a job on Tottenham by accident.
No.
He knew what he was doing, and just because he was missing some of his best players, which will have been a contributing factor to the way they played and set out, he put the best possible game plan together he could with what he had available, and that was good enough to win on the day. If Tottenham played the way they did against sort of maybe 14 other teams in the Premier League, they'd probably have won that game 1-0 or 2-0.
I mean, because we had another question. I'm just chucking these in now because they're sort of very relevant to the conversation. It would seem a bit weird to shoehorn them in later on. Lee, who has a spectacular handle of at Moody Tosser, another one of my alter egos, asks, do you think Conte is tactically a better manager than Pochettino? I mean, it's kind of hard to quantify that, really, isn't it? But I guess the point is, do you think Conte is quite good at getting the better of Pochettino in these games?
Clearly. I mean, what, they've played each other 4 times. Pochettino's won 1 and Conte's won 3. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, but the one in which we did beat them, we fucking hammered them as well. The 2-0, wasn't it, at home? Dele Alli getting those 2 identical goals.
Yeah, so it's not as if Pochettino's a terrible manager, but Conte obviously knows how to pick his horses for courses.
He's a lot more experienced, right, as a manager.
Yeah, he's had international management, he's worked his way up through the lower leagues, he's managed Juventus, he's done a lot more than Pochettino has. I don't think they're actually too dissimilar in ages or anything, it's just that Conte worked himself up a bit quicker than Pochettino has. And maybe there is a case to be made that tactically Conte is slightly more astute than Pochettino is. I don't think that's a particularly divisive thing to say, but there are areas in which Pochettino is better than Conte is.
I think, having hair.
You know, his man management is clearly better because Conte is a walking disaster area where that's concerned. His players seem to like him for parts of last season, but half their issue at the moment is that he's managed to help implode any sort of semblance of, you know, team spirit they had, because he can't be stopping himself texting people and saying shit about people and being.
Yeah, he got into a weird actual, like, childish beef with Diego Costa, didn't he?
Well, they're still in the middle of it. The reason that Costa's not playing for him is he texted him and said, you're not in my plans anymore. And then they failed to sign Lukaku, which he thought was going to happen. And they've signed Morata, who was sort of their second choice. And he sort of needs Costa to play for him now, and he refuses to because he wants to go back to Atletico, and his manager told him he was, you know, done for at the club, and now he's had to go grovelling back. So it's that's never happened with Pochettino. No. Even when we talk about this Rose thing, we talk about the Walker thing, he's handled it perfectly. So there's areas in which, you know, if you're going to give him areas out of 10, that maybe Conte's a point or two more than Pochettino, but there's areas in other areas in which Pochettino's a better manager than he is. It's such a multifaceted role and different things like that, that, you know, you've got to give him credit. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks that Conte's done miraculously well with the Chelsea youth system or anything, because he hasn't. There's nobody you'd really point to as him having brought through. And if he has as big a say or as much influence as Pochettino does over our academy, then he would have done, because there's, you know what, 40, 50 players that Chelsea have got out on loan or something absurd.
Ridiculous,
and surely there's
isn't
a player
it?
In there he'd have picked out on. And he's obviously done all right jobs with the likes of Victor Moses and whatnot that have been written off by other managers, but they're not youth players. Victor Moses has played really well for other clubs for a long time before Conte came along. It's just that he gave him a role and trained him in a way that...
Arguably, he's lost. I mean, I think Loftus-Cheek's gone permanently, hasn't he? And Solanke's gone as well,
permanently. No, Loftus-Cheek, they're on loan. I think Loftus-Cheek's on loan, and Solanke's definitely left. One of the Shalabert has gone. So there's a few that have gone, but, you know, some of that falls on the shoulders of Michael Emenalo as well. So you've got to wonder how, to what extent his hands are tied where that's concerned. But like I say, if he was more vocal about it, if he was more concentrated on that aspect of their club, I don't think Emenalo is going to stand in his way of promoting players if that's what he wants to do. But it doesn't appear to be something he's particularly interested in.
He would have been, just from the few times I've seen him, he'd have been quite a nice signing, that Solanke. He does look quite a decent player. But
I don't think Chelsea are in a rush to sell anyone to Tottenham at the minute.
No, that's true. Well, I could bet that he was free agent, wasn't he? Liverpool just had to pay a tribunal fee, I think, for him, of about 4 or 5 mil, next to nothing. But anyway, who cares? Right, let's move on. Burnley, who, interestingly enough, as much as it's all doom and gloom us losing at home to Chelsea, Chelsea lost their opening game of the season at home to Burnley, which is hopefully not a bit of a kind of ominous.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
A sign for Spurs, it would be a bit miserable at the moment to have this sort of loss compounded by also losing to Burnley. No disrespect. Well, come on, let's be honest. A bit of disrespect to Burnley. You would hope that we would turn up and smash them in this, considering they have just lost at home to West Brom as well in their second fixture. They've just signed today. What's his name, that lad? The Leeds lad?
Chris Wood.
Any good?
No, he's all right. Like I was telling you, he's sort of your bog-standard championship striker. He scored a lot of goals because he was in the right places, but there's nothing particularly exciting about him. We've seen plenty of players of his ilk step up to the Premier League and fail. For my money, the likes of Jordan Rhodes are more impressive players than he is at championship level, but he scored more goals than they did, so you don't know how they're going to, you know, tech off when they come up to the Premier League. There's nothing I'd be particularly worried about where he's concerned, because he's not going to be, you know, too au fait with what Burnley do, although I don't think Sean Dyche's tactics are that complicated to get your head around. So it's not as if I'm suddenly scared of playing Burnley because I've signed Chris Wood. But, you know, if we thought that Chelsea came and played shit football against us. Fuck knows what Burnley are going to do, because they're awful. And it works for them, in fairness, but they are awful. They were one of the worst sides I saw at White Hart Lane last year.
They're so boring.
The thing is, you don't want to go too far in that direction and write them off too much playing shit football, because they know how to do it and they know how to hurt you doing it. I don't think that the Chelsea game is too much to be worried about either with Burnley, because that was an anomaly given the way Chelsea played, their mood and their approach to that game, and the sendings off and whatnot. If anything, going forward, given how they played against Tottenham, maybe that's a blessing in disguise. Because, it was last season when Chelsea got hammered by Arsenal that Conte sort of changed things, and after they got hammered by Burnley, he changed things again and did things a different way, and perhaps they've had their wake-up call that they needed, and maybe that Chelsea game will act as Spurs, as we don't know. But Burnley are just... We know what they're going to do and we know how they're going to do it. We just have to be better than them and score early enough that they have to come out, because the longer it goes on at 0-0, the deeper they'll get and the more they'll try and catch us on the break. So it's the most predictable game we'll have all season, apart from West Brom. But the fact they lost to West Brom at home is just because both of those clubs try and play shit football in almost exactly the same manner. And Tony Pulis just a better version of it. And he's got Gary Megson as his assistant now. So it's almost they've got this weird, axis of evil of shit football together. The two shit football masterminds at West Brom who managed to overpower Daesh. So it's not something I'm particularly worried about, but it's just one of those where you can't not give them any respect and you can't not be prepared for them, because that's what they feed off and that's what they hope for. You've just got to have the right attitude and have the right approach, and then you'll beat them.
Do you think we'll... I can't see us lining up the same way that we did against Chelsea. You'd probably see Son coming back into the mix, wouldn't you, for this one?
I see no reason as to why not, no. There's all sorts of things we could do. There's no...
I wouldn't mind seeing Harry Winks get given a go as well, to be honest. Maybe not from the start, but I'd like to see him get a few minutes in this one.
Yeah, well, this game will be about how intelligently we can use the ball in the final third. So the more players we can have on the field that do that without exposing ourselves, the better. If Trippier's not ready, then give Walker Peters another run out. If I actually thought, in fairness to Ben Davies, he wasn't bad against
Chelsea. Thought he was all right,
He got forward more than most, did he? I think he had more decent shots at goal than many of them.
Oh, yeah, he had that one, like that absolute kind of cracker, didn't he?
He's got 2-2 Premier League games before this one, so he's obviously on a bit of a high and stuff, so he's not actually a concern anymore. He was one of the better players against Chelsea, so it's one of those where, as long as they win, they put a few more smiles on people's faces and whatnot. I mean, this next week's going to be long because the window's still open and people are going to be overanalyzing and overreacting to that Chelsea game so much that it's one of those where they have to win to sort of keep people sane. Otherwise, a draw or a loss against Burnley at home is just going to be such a negative and, dig themselves into such a hole in terms of momentum and atmosphere that it's really best avoided.
It would be, it's not, let's not buy into the hyperbole of it. It's not going to be an actual catastrophe, but it would be pretty fucking miserable. We need to make a statement at Wembley now. We need to get it done.
It would take about 3 hours before the think piece on Tottenham's bubble bursting came out if things didn't go right against Burnley at home. So it's one of those where you just got to anticipate that, know what your job is and play better and win the match. It's just about being professional, because where quality is concerned, where tactics or anything like that are concerned, Tottenham are bigger and better and more impressive in every single department. And the only reason as to why they would lose a match like that is because of negligence, and they just have to make sure their attitude is good enough that, being negligent isn't something that bites him in the ass.
Should we go on to some listener questions?
If we must.
We've had one from Philip at Single Malt Suds, who asks us, what do you make of the drum? modern football nuisance, or yeah, of course it needed to be mic'd up, or else you wouldn't hear it. Just this is in reference to the fact that we had a drum playing through the actual tannoy at this stadium yesterday.
So was somebody actually?
I'm not sure.
Was somebody playing the drum, or have they bought like 12 drum songs on a CD and started playing it through the PA system?
This is what I couldn't work out, mate.
I mean, neither's particularly great, but if it's the latter, then somebody needs sacking.
Yeah, I mean, either way, to be honest, either way, if it was Arsenal, I'd be ripping the piss out of that. You know, it's. I get it to an extent, because it is very hard to get the atmosphere going in a ground. It's not so much even the size of the ground, it's the way in which it's built. It's a real catastrophic stadium for atmosphere, Wembley. I mean, I'm so glad the club are using that as a template to learn from, essentially how not to build a stadium going forwards. And we've seen that with the sort of steepness of our stands and the proximity to the pitch. Whether or not that actually does have a tangible effect on atmosphere remains to be seen. You'd imagine it would do.
The problem with Wembley is that it's not a football stadium. It's this weird events arena.
Yeah.
The FA want there so they can have everything under the sun at it. So it's not been purpose-built for any one thing. They want to be able to do everything in it. And, you know, you can't be all things to all people. And when you try to be, it's inevitably shit.
I mean, you would still hope that they had football in mind when they were first building it, though, wouldn't you? But I do know
you don't know anything about the FA, do you?
No.
So consistently stupid and irresponsible and, you know, just poor at their jobs from almost top to bottom. It wouldn't surprise you if they, you know, hired the wrong people to design it and had the wrong intentions going into it. And, you know, but that stadium was so late and so, you know, overpriced and everything. It's a joke from start to finish. And, you know, people are still paying for that. The fact that we've got FA Cup semi-finals and shit there is because they're still paying back debt on it and whatnot. So it's, you know, the entire operation, if you were going to do sort of an appraisal afterwards, there's no way that you could, you know, spin it as if it was good, because it's not. It's not a great place. If you're going to have to go there once or twice a year or something for a big game, then you don't complain, because the size of it is impressive if you've forgotten how big it is every now and then. But it's not somewhere you'd want to go every week, especially to watch your own team.
No, I think the first time I'd been there was, I think it's, we had a pre-season a good few years ago against Barcelona there. I think that's the first time I ever went to New Wembley.
Wembley Cup.
Yeah, and my immediate reaction was, fucking hell, this is massive. Like, it was pretty, you know, awe-inspiring when I first walked into the ground, but it just doesn't hold an atmosphere. It's just not great. It's, I don't know, we can go on about that all day. But in terms of this drum, the drum over the tannoy, I think it's something they have to avoid. They've got to hope they get the drum in an actual area of the ground and hope that it just catches organically, because I think it's too plastic playing your, it's one stage removed from goal music, right?
You know, goal music's cousin.
It's like the old rumor that in the Emirates, and you don't know how much of this is a Tottenham fan kind of slanderous type rumor or not, but apparently, like, on some of the Champions League games, when they kind of only half fill the Emirates, they'll play like a crowd hum over the tannoy and stuff like that to make it feel a bit more full, which is, yeah, I don't
crowd
know.
Crowd hum?
Yeah, just a sort of general ambient soundtrack. It's probably a bit tinfoil hat or, you know, Tottenham band.
Well, fuck knows, okay. If they've got a 10 favourite Spurs chant drum CD, then what's possible?
So we've had Elliot.
It'd be even funnier if it was like, and they've hired a drummer who's been mic'd up himself and he's in some cupboard in the side of Wembley drumming along these songs, and there's a guy on him like a walkie-talkie going, "It's a bit quiet out there, can you give us..."
Oh, don't, mate. That
give
just,
us a song.
The Chelsea fans are singing fucking anti-Semitic stuff again. Quick, drown it out, you know. Let's have a look at one of the next questions. We've had... All right, here's a good one. YB at YBear_ asks, if we were to go and sign a pacey winger, how would they fit into the 3-4-3?
They'd play on one of the sides of the three at the front.
Just the inverted forward thing.
Yeah. They play on the wing.
I would like to see us sign a pacey attacker, you know.
Well, I wrote a thing like last month, didn't I, saying that we've never replaced peak Aaron Lennon.
And yeah, by that. No, I agree.
Just sometimes, you know, somebody who runs really fucking quickly around people is a very effective way of getting the ball into dangerous areas. There's nothing particularly clever about it. There's nothing new about it. But the reason fast people do really well at playing football is that they're really hard to catch. So perhaps one or two of them might help. Nakudu looked quite exciting in pre-season, but we've yet to see any existence of his existence in season proper. You know, any, I don't see any harm in giving him a run out against Burnley from the start. If he's shit, take him off at half time. But at least we've tried it and seen what he can do. Because up until now, he's sort of more of an idea than a player.
He's a theory.
Yeah, it's just, what's the point in having him there if he's not going to do anything?
Marcus Edwards apparently had a bit of a mare in the under-23s today, but he's been injured for ages with an ankle ligament injury.
Well, that's where what you're going to do in youth football, isn't it? It's where you learn how to play football. So
yeah.
You don't particularly worry about him having bad games in youth football.
Oh, no, but I just mean in the respect that a lot of people are touting him for the first team already, you know, when he's still not really consistent in the youth leagues by the sound of things. Right, put it this way, mate. This is a question from me to you.
Okay.
So let's say 50 mil, 80 grand a week. Would you take Riyad Mahrez before the transfer window closes?
No.
No?
Because I'm not particularly impressed by him,
no,
to be quite honest. But, you know, I'm sure he'd do a job, but he's just not the type of footballer I'm particularly fond of. Not as if I'd actively cheer against him or anything if he came to Spurs, but I get the impression that he wouldn't come for 80 grand. He wants to go somewhere for double, and he sort of, you know, this is his chance to get a really big move and whatnot. So I wouldn't be too fond of it, because to be quite honest, if we're going to be getting a winger of that ilk, I don't think they're going to be the immediate first choice in the team, and he wants to be. He's not going to come in and take Eriksen's place or Ali's place or Kane's place. He's not going to be good enough to force us to change formation or anything. So it's one of those where I think it's probably more trouble than it's worth. It strikes me as one of those things that it's, you know, 10:30 and the window closes in half an hour, and Daniel Levy's, you know, his hand's itching above his phone. He goes, you know what, let's bid 50 million for Mahrez and see what happens.
You can see happening though, can't you?
Yeah, but
not the actual deal. I mean, that scenario that you're outlining there.
Well, it's happened so many times. You not remember when we tried to sign Aguero on transfer deadline day and Charlie Adam, and
that was miserable.
Who else?
Although Charlie Adam was, to be fair, was all right at that point. Not good, but he was all right. He wasn't kind of the Charlie Adam we know and detest nowadays, but he was still Charlie Adam.
Yeah, exactly. So it was just, you know, he's done this plenty of times.
Wasn't it as well? I think we bid at that point.
Yeah, I think the only reason why it didn't come off is there was like not a board member at one of the two of the clubs who was awake or something. So it was, you know, on its way through, but he'd literally made the phone call and tried to make the deal happen with about 2 minutes to spare.
Thank God for that. That's lucky. Let's see. I think we had one.
I mean, there is an upside. I mean, the Van der Vaart deal and whatnot, that dragged through to the next day after the window, but that was, you know, a dream bit of business.
We've had, that was exceptional. I think
$8 million for Rafa van der Vaart. Thank you very much.
And just the size of the player as well. I don't.
I mean, he was a bit fat, but there's no need to make any
But I don't think pulling out my sort of semi-dark credentials here, but I've never, yeah, it's the biggest deal probably since Jurgen Klinsmann, that in terms of like the gravitas and the size of the player and his international standing. It was a real statement that, oh, it's just so good.
I think it happened around my 18th birthday, and I was just remember being so excited about it. It was back when sort of I had so little to do that I could sort of sit and watch Sky Sports News for 24 solid hours and just follow deals and shit like that. But it was...
came out of nowhere, though, didn't it, really?
It came out of nowhere. It was, you know, people didn't believe it was going to happen. Like I said, it wasn't made official until the day after the window had closed because paperwork and whatnot. But, yeah, that was a fun time to be buying people late in the window. It was far more exciting than Moussa Sissoko was.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. It's just miserable, that one, isn't it?
Didn't we buy Dempsey at, like, 5 minutes before the window closed and...
I think so. I mean, Dempsey would have been all right. Just, you know, he's competing with Gareth Bale. Like,
he scored goals. He wore a stupid number, but he scored the winner against Man United and scored a few goals and whatnot. But it was just a strange signing at a strange time. But that's what Tottenham did. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. But yeah, less said about that, the better.
Rowan Stewart at RS_THFC. Has rather problematically asked us why do I want to hit Marcus Alonso with a car.
No comment.
Yeah. Matthew Borum at MBorum1 has asked, should Spurs bid 20 mil for Noy, Noy? Do you think he's not talking about your lad Moy, is he, at Huddersfield? Or am I missing is Noy a Football Manager special?
I don't think he's on about Aaron Moy, no. What's he spell? How's he spelling it?
Noy.
It's not coming up on Google. I've never heard of him.
I think it must be Moy, mate. I think it's a typo.
I don't think 20 million is going to get you Aaron Moy in this window, given that he's just gone for 8 to 10. And he wouldn't come straight into our team. But there's a number of clubs that should have bought Aaron Moy that aren't Huddersfield, because it would have made their teams immediately better.
How old is he?
It's like, he's 26, I think.
Okay.
So he's in his prime. And Sykes, who I got to football with, said to me yesterday, is he the best footballer that doesn't play for a top six team? And I, off the top of my head, I couldn't think of one. So he's definitely in that conversation.
What is he? He's like a playmaker, centre midfielder type.
He used to be a number 10 when he was Australia, but David Wagner's made him into a sort of a withdrawn playmaker in the first band of midfield, but he does his work defensively. He's literally everywhere. His work rate is fantastic.
Australian Luka Modric.
Essentially, yeah. But he's fantastic to watch. He's a really good footballer. He wouldn't come in straight away to Spurs. The one player I wouldn't mind putting into the Spurs system is Phil Billing, who's the 6'5" Danish version of Aaron Moy, who plays next to him because Hoggy's out injured. But I'd have Billing in because he's young and I'm sure Pochettino could do a thing or two with him. Why Everton didn't buy him or West Ham or Southampton or whatnot, I'm not sure. But he's a fantastic footballer. I'm not sure I'd want to see him at Spurs because I don't think he'd get the opportunities he deserves and that there are better fits for him elsewhere. He's not the type of personality that'll force his way into the first team or whatnot. But if we were going to have somebody who just sort of rotates in and out of the side, he'll be fantastic. But he's not somebody I would go out and buy for us.
What about Mooney?
he can head the ball really well, but I'm not sure. Maybe that might be a choice of sort of a bring him on and kick the ball high because he works really hard. He doesn't stop running. He's better with his feet than most people give him credit for. So he might be an option as sort of a, you know, we're 0-0 with Burnley and there's 15 minutes to go, big stick Mooney up top and see what happens. But I'm not sure Tottenham are that type of club. We'll see.
Is there any player in particular that this is again from ATU, is there anyone that stands out? You know, like for example, like I had my man crush on Victor Wanyama for many years. Is there any sort of one player that and not even in this, if money were no object, a realistic purchase for Spurs that you would quite like to see us make that you think would improve the side?
To be honest, I've stopped thinking about transfers in that way. There's no one that I do. The last one that I did was Ben Davies, and that's eventually turned out all right. But it's because I sort of enjoy the direction Tottenham have gone in over the past few seasons, where we've bought players that we haven't been too aware of and turned them into more exciting talents and promoting players through the youth team. That's been a far more enjoyable way of following the club than going, oh my God, there's this Brazilian midfielder who's the Brazilian Frank Lampard. I can't believe we've got him. And then he turns up and can't do fucking five kick-ups. So I think we've had his fingers burnt too much with getting excited over somebody because they've got a name and a half-decent YouTube reel. I'm more excited by the unknown. And that might just be me getting older and world weary now, but I'm not sure. There's no one that particularly sticks out in my mind, to be honest. There are players I obviously like, but how realistic they are, I'm not sure. So it's one of those where I just let the club get on with what they do, and we'll see. I mean, Davis and Sanchez isn't a player that particularly stuck out to me whenever I've seen Ajax recently, but having read what people have said about him, having seen how obviously interested the club are in him, knowing that, you know, Kevin Wimmer's been in Pochettino's bad books for like a year and a half now, there's excitement there because I want to see what the club make of this exciting young player. So I'd rather that than sort of getting myself hung up over a Mahrez or something, because you'll always, you know, it's always like a 14-year-old kid or a 50-year-old man that reply to everything to Tottenham tweet going sign so-and-so or announce so-and-so and all that sort of disgraceful behaviour. But
you're saying you're definitely not one of those skills, assists, goals, HD YouTuber watchers anymore?
No, definitely not.
You know, I've got to admit to the fact that when we signed Davinson Sanchez, I did actually watch one of those reels on YouTube, and Charlotte caught me and called me a paedophile.
Did she break off the marriage? Because I would have.
I think it was close to. She actually did demand that I turn it off and, you know, reassess.
I like the fact that, you know, you get to learn these players in a sort of a Tottenham context and whatnot. I don't like having the expectations of seeing what they're going to do, because most of the time when they come to Tottenham, what Pochettino makes them do is completely different to what they've done before, and that's half the enjoyment of it. So, there's nobody I would particularly hang my hat on wanting to come.
Have you read up on...
Like I say, I'd take Billing and stick him in the youth team and see what we could make of him.
Have you read up on Ozark yet, mate?
No, I've completely forgot about it as soon as I hung up. I've got my computer in front of me. How do I spell it? Ozark.
That's the one.
Not going to lie, mate, it sounds shit. American crime drama thriller. Already, to me, it doesn't know what genre it is. Jason Bateman, that's not a good sign.
Do you not like? Oh, I quite like Jason Bateman.
Jason Bateman can't act. Jason Bateman is Jason Bateman, and everything is. I'll put him in the same category as I do Tobey Maguire, because Tobey Maguire is fucking Tobey Maguire, no matter how he is. Do I want to see Spider-Man?
Probably fair, but
Tobey Maguire in tights.
I think what Jason Bateman is better than what Tobey Maguire is.
He's just a different version of Tobey Maguire. It's like
he doesn't have that puffy, cryy face all the time. That funny mouth and tongue. He's got the Jamie Oliver tongue, Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of either. Let me just read the synopsis. Financial planner, I like Laura Linney.
She's brilliant.
She relocates family to... Sounds a bit boring. It's about money laundering. Is that it?
Give it a go then, mate. I must say. I mean, it's not reinventing the wheel. Let me just, all right, I know I've sort of brought it up again. We're not talking like, it's not Sopranos or anything like that. But as far as like a random Netflix series goes, it's pretty decent. I'd give it 6 tusks out of 10.
Jesus. Where is it like sort of 0 to Stranger Things?
Oh, 0 to Stranger Things. Five.
That's not a recommendation, is it?
5 verging 6, but I mean, Stranger Things is setting the bar pretty high, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's not a lot of time before we shuffle off this mortal coil, and I'm not sure I've got enough time in my life for 5s anymore. I'm being completely honest with you.
The annoying thing is, I'm being conservative there because I know you'll watch it and be like, that was shite, but.
I've not even watched it, I've said it was shite.
Watch it. If not,
Have you watched this week's Game of Thrones?
I have you?
Yeah. People will watch it by the time this podcast comes out. Otherwise, if you've not seen this week's episode of Game of Thrones, as in like the one that came out 2 o'clock our time, Sunday night, Monday morning, then I'd avoid this chat. Yeah,
turn off that, because it's going to be the end of the pod now anyway. So yeah. Turn off from this point.
You do the podcast sign off, and then we'll talk about Game of Thrones.
If you want to listen to all the previous episodes of Rulerish Podcast, you can do so on Acast or iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at RTR_pod or visit the website rtrpod.com. Now we're going to talk about the latest Game of Thrones with spoilers and all that shit in it.
Yeah, so if your Twitter is going, why do you talk about Game of Thrones and spoil it, Mario? You're a fucking idiot.
Yeah, and you haven't been listening properly, so you deserve it.
It's your own fault. Yeah, because we've mentioned it about 10 times now. But yeah, proceed.
Mate, so I... You know, it's everything that we've been talking about to this point with this series. I actually...
And times about 100.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to pretend like I'm not enjoying it, because I am still enjoying it. That's the thing. Yeah. I appreciate it despite its many flaws. I see, you know, there are numerous flaws to this. One of the big ones being that was pointed out in an article I read, because I had some thoughts about it, and I thought, let's see, you know, how these align with what other people are saying. Am I just being a bit of a twat? And one of the things I was thinking is, like, if it was such an effort for them to even convince Daenerys that this army of the dead exists or anything like that, to even let them go, it just seems so bizarre that they could suddenly send a raven and she's like, actually, fuck it, you know what, I'll fly over there with my dragons and just do this anyway. Why didn't they just do that in the first place? If she was that easily led, why couldn't they? They could have still created this arc whereby Daenerys rides over there with Jon. They have the other dragon. The Night King still kills the other dragon and she has that vengeful hatred for the dead as well as having seen them. But they just...
I think the point of it, though, is that her and Jon spending time together sort of sets up this weird, another incest weird thing where she obviously wants a bit of her nephew's dick. And that's her real thing, because that's why she stood at the wall waiting for him to come back and didn't want to leave, is because she is having feels for her nephew. Because they don't know yet. It's less creepy than Jaime and Cersei, but still creepy because we know. So I think that's one of the lesser points that I'm annoyed about. Sort of, I came away from this episode with two feelings, the first of which was, this show is now fucking ridiculous and I enjoy it regardless.
Yeah.
And two is that Game of Thrones was a great program when it was peak Thrones, because of the source material of George R. R. Martin, despite the obvious lack of skill of Benioff and Weiss. Because when this show's become their creative outlook, they're clearly not very good at what they do. The plot holes now are so big that you can march an army of the dead through them. The fact that, you know, when it was sort of 10-episode series, little hints and things as to things were going to happen, or, you know, when somebody said they were going to do something, like John would go, I'm going to go back to the wall and do this. He would say it in episode 2 and he wouldn't be at the wall until episode 7.
Exactly. And it's losing
now,
that. Like,
they've done fucking 10 trips back and forth as if it's round corner one episode.
Because you don't get the same... don't get me wrong, on face value, it was fucking cool to see the dragon swoop over the wall and come in as soon as they needed it to sweep up a load of the undead and blah, 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 blah. But the dramatic effect was lessened so much by the fact that this epic journey across halfway across the country is over in 2 minutes. Like, they need Daenerys, and then suddenly she's there. It just...
How fast was that fucking raven flying?
You know?
How fast was Gendry running?
Exactly. Like, it's ridiculous. And it is
because it cheapens the effect and the payoff. Because had they done all that, they can have those same set pieces as they have done in the past. But if that had been sort of teased and done over so many more episodes and things, and it being, you know, you can see... Since the very first episode, since the very first season, we've known at some point these creepy dead alien things and this Night King, who's apparently the world's best javelin thrower, are going to eventually come face to face, and it's going to be this weird fantasy fight-off, and that's what you're waiting to pay off for like 6-odd series now. But the fact that that's all happened within sort of one episode rather than having been built up to, you know, over the course of 4 or 5, which it needed to be, or should have been, or would have been in days gone by. It just feels as if it's a bit of a rush job. I mean, like I say, it's enjoyable, but it's not the same quality as it once was.
Mm.
I mean, it's giving you every single thing you want, and there's not one point of it that I actually disagree with in terms of plot. It's just how it's handled.
Yeah, I think that the only thing I would say that I think we have to take into account is that the hand has been forced slightly in the budgetary restrictions and such have meant that the seasons have got to be a bit shorter and they've had to wrap it up in 2 seasons. So I kind of get why they might
be. Is that the case? Or surely they know that this is the biggest show on Earth and that they can, you know... How many more episodes would it have been? 4, 7 more episodes. They can't stretch out 7 episodes over the course of 2 seasons to give the show the ending it deserves, because this could have been their version of Sopranos and Wire. They could have been in that conversation, and now they're in the tier below, and it's only because they've rushed the ending.
I would honestly say probably even a couple of tiers below now. I think it's even, to be honest, the way it's ending, I think it's falling beneath like Breaking Bad and such now.
Well, the joy of Breaking Bad and the reason why that was so good is there was not an episode or a second rushed on that program. They got to tell the story they wanted to do in the time they wanted to do it. And that doesn't feel the case here. This randomly sort of everything seems to be happening at once. And it's almost as if, you know, if George R. R. Martin had been in charge of it, I imagine somebody important would have probably died at one point in one of these things. One of the little side plots that's pissing me off the most is Littlefinger at Winterfell and the Starkville.
That's boring.
It's just so obviously done and so badly handled. And it's
really corny though as well, isn't it?
Well, they want you to obviously have this feeling and have this conflict of the two sisters, but it's just so ham-fistedly done because there's
because they're going to find out that it's him and they're going to kill him. So just why even bother, you know? It's so obvious.
Yeah, it's not great. But it's like I say, it's enjoyable, but it's not the program it once was. So I've already shifted my expectations on it enough to go, this is going to be daft and I'll enjoy it for being daft. But it's not the program that I would sort of... You used to watch an episode of Game of Thrones and they would throw off 20 different, like, side stories and it would almost be half of them are red herrings and, like, the 3 or 4 that are important you wouldn't almost grasp hold of until they'd been drip-fed to you a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But now they only have, like, 2 main stories, which obviously weren't going to happen. They can't have done that all the way through. But it's just the way they've brought everyone back together and sort of concentrated the story into its conclusion has been so elegantly done in comparison to how intricate and how well set up it had been previously. That it's just, you know, it's a bit of a shame, really.
It is. Right, let's kill it there. Thanks for listening. Come on, you Spurs.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.